We're checking in on the race to find a safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the New York Times' coronavirus vaccine tracker, researchers are testing 45 vaccines in clinical trials on people. 11 vaccines are in large-scale phase 3 testing. And we learned this week Johnson & Johnson paused its phase 3 trial to investigate an illness in a study volunteer. So what questions do you have about what it takes to make a safe and effective vaccine? Will you trust one when one becomes available or more become available? We're at 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Leo Nisala, who is a physician and clinical scientist in San Francisco, focusing on clinical trials and drug development. Dr. Nisala, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hi. So we're seeing, you know, Johnson & Johnson and other pharmaceutical companies pausing their vaccine trials after, something happens, whether it's a participant who is sick or otherwise. What is happening here with these pauses?
That's a great point to start the conversation. And like every American, I'm too excited about a COVID vaccine. And I do think that a vaccine will allow us to go get life back to normal. But vaccine trials that have paused did so by an abundance of caution. So first, let me assure folks at home listening to this that the recent pauses in the clinical trials studying a potential coronavirus vaccine due to safety concern should not cause you to worry. This is science at work, and this is how the normal process of data review goes. So when discussing a potential new vaccine, there are some important points to consider. And one of them is that vaccines have significantly reduced the prevalence of many diseases, yet they need to be studied and need to understand how the body reacts to those vaccines. So on Tuesday, we learned that the late stage trial of the Eli Lilly antibody treatment for COVID was paused. And just earlier, we learned that J&J's coronavirus vaccine trial was being paused and the safety monitoring board was examining the adverse event. And prior to that, AstraZeneca's vaccine trial being paused in the United States, but it was reopened in the United Kingdom after a subject failed. So typically it takes years to complete those studies. But those trial pauses are not uncommon in the development of vaccine and drugs.
They're not uncommon. So it's not something that we should certainly be alarmed by. But do we know why, for instance, AstraZeneca can reboot its clinical trials in other parts of the world, but still on hold in the U.S.? What's going on there?
So AstraZeneca is in partnership with Oxford University in the U.K., and they are partnering with other institutions across the world. The FDA has its own standard process to review those safety implications, and in this case, an unexplained illness in a subject that was participating in a trial in the United Kingdom. And the FDA has yet to respond to AstraZeneca whether they're going to reopen the trial or not. So this, again, it's not uncommon, and that has happened in the past with other trials as well.
So when a trial is paused, though, is that a concern where the trial may not be started again and the trial is basically scrapped?
So the trial may be paused in a specific manner, let's say one in the United States, but may continue in other parts of the world. And that would add to the evidence of the body of the evidence that they're collecting from these vaccine subjects when they subject the vaccine for registration, for example. The trial may continue elsewhere and does not necessarily need to be completed here.
We're talking with Dr. Leo Nisala, who's a physician and research scientist focusing on clinical trials and drug development, taking your questions as well as we watch the step-by-step process of a COVID vaccine go through the phases. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Liam, who is joining us from Eau Claire this morning. Hi, Liam.
Hi. I had a question based on, why do the vaccines have to be paused if someone falls ill during one of the trials, and how do they effectively pause those trials?
Great questions. Go ahead, Dr. Nisala.
Yeah, so usually in clinical studies that we are comparing a vaccine to placebo, there is a process in which you analyze in real time the patient's data and to see how the body will be reacting to the drug that you're giving it. So in this case, for vaccine development, you want to ensure that not only the drug is safe, but it has some clinical activity there. In order for you to do that, companies will look at, you know, patient data and looking at the subject's information to understand if the vaccine is safe to continue or not. Should there be any signal to of alarm, the companies stop the trial and pause it for a moment to analyze the data before continuing to dose subjects. That's a standard process. And although it's quite paradoxical, it's also very reassuring, because we expect to see these signals that may not indicate a problem. And we expect to see these companies stopping this trial so they can carefully look at the clinical data and see if there's anything else happening to the body of the participants who are receiving this experimental vaccine. So this is a natural process, but because we are in this pandemic together and all the processes for drug development have speed up so much, it's natural for folks to be alarmed, but the opposite. It gives us doctors and scientists the reassurance that we are not cutting corners on safety.
Dr. Nisala, can you step back for us and explain the phases, the phase one trial, phase two, phase three, and how a vaccine comes to market?
Of course, yeah. So when we talk about vaccine development, we have to look at all the phases that it takes from the starting of the design of the clinical trial concept all the way to having a vaccine fully approved for broad use. So the first human studies, which are the phase one studies, where companies look for vaccine safety, and also they look for the effective dose. So those are the phase one studies. And currently for COVID-19, there are 30 vaccine being studied there. On the phase two studies, when you expand the number of patients and the patient population gets a little bit more defined, the phase two studies, we are also looking at the safety implications of the study and the dose that you have chosen in the prior phase. And there are currently 15 candidates there. For the phase three trials, where the very large scale efficacy tests, you're looking to see how the clinical efficacy that you hypothesize based on the phase one and phase two studies are going to behave a larger scale population to see if your data on safety actually holds. And there are currently 11 candidates on that phase.
Who finds out or who knows who is taking a placebo in these trials?
So studies that are usually blinded, you have a subject that's receiving a drug that, so the subject doesn't know that he or she is receiving a vaccine or a placebo. And in most cases, the investigator also doesn't know. So the doctors and the research team and the staff does not know. Who does see that information that is masked is the company. So some individuals within the company who are developing these drugs have access to understanding which subject is receiving which drug, but that is very dependent on the study itself.
So very dependent on the study itself, but, you know, very critical information as you assess whether, I would suppose, that trial can progress from one phase to the next.
That's correct.
We're talking with Dr. Leo Nisola, who works in clinical trial development. We're talking about the race to manufacture a safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19. Are you perhaps in a clinical trial now? Maybe it's for cancer or for another type of trial. What is it like? What do you see as the advantages of participating in a clinical trial? What are the drawbacks? Join in with your questions and your experiences, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Nisola here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing vaccine development here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Vaccines typically require years of research and trials before reaching our doctor's office, our clinic, but scientists are trying to rapidly produce a vaccine by next year, and we're all watching. What concerns do you have about the COVID vaccine trials? What questions do you have about the stages of development and the role of the FDA in regulation? Are you in a clinical trial? Tell us about it, 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Leo Nisola, who's a physician and research scientist who focuses on clinical trials and drug development. He's our guide. Let's take another call now. Paris is joining us from Muskego this morning. Hi, Paris.
Hi, good morning. I had a question for the expert. How do you know how efficacious the vaccine is going to be, given that there are potentially different strains and different mutations of COVID? You know, the only thing that the public really has to compare it to is the flu vaccine, which is similarly, you know, one vaccine geared towards one particular influenza virus, but there are many different mutations and strains of the flu.
Paris, thanks. Dr. Nisola, what about efficacy? What can you tell us?
That's a great question, actually, and thanks for asking it. So vaccine efficacy, it's usually dependent on the percentage of the reduction of the disease in a group of people compared to the people that were not vaccinated. That's usually using the most favorable of the conditions. But, you know, in different diseases, the efficacy and the effectiveness will be measured differently. So each one of those clinical studies that we mentioned today have different endpoints that at the end of the day, we want to make sure that, number one, it's safe for a healthy individual to receive, as at the same time that is safe for someone who has comorbidities like obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure. It's also safe for them to receive. And at the same time that it protects against a specific disease that you're vaccinating. An important point on this process is that not every vaccine candidate is successful. So we have examples through the course of history of vaccine development that some studies failed. And just to give a little bit perspective on the very uniqueness of the moment which we live in now, COVID-19 lives in the shadow of the most vaccine virus we've faced. In HIV, after nearly 40 years of work, we have yet to find a vaccine for it. And back in 2007, researchers stopped a vaccine study because it seemed to be increasing the risk of the HIV infection. So that was a trial that actually failed. The vaccine that was built on the backbone was made from a modified virus called adenovirus. And in that trial, people that were being infected with the adenovirus 5, they actually developed more of the diseases related to HIV than people who didn't. And one theory there is that some people responded more strongly than others to a component of the vaccine that was stress tested in that trial, STEP trial, making them more vulnerable to HIV. So, short story, HIV was discovered almost 40 years ago, and we still have not found a vaccine for it,
Because
which I.
an individual's reaction can vary from one person to the next. Everyone's
That.
body is unique.
That's correct. And that's why I think the listener's question was so important, because it's important to understand all sorts of patients' populations when we are studying vaccines. I do not think that this is going to happen with COVID. There are so many contenders and so many different approaches. However, that's something that has happened in the past.
So, what is considered to be a successful, effective vaccine? I mean, certainly it's not 100% effectiveness because, as I think we've understood this before, that that's just a really high bar, impossible bar to set.
Yeah, that's right. And I think without going into the numbers of what effectiveness look like, one important part is an important point is folks that are healthy should remain healthy while receiving a vaccine, and folks that have comorbidities and underlying conditions should feel safe enough to receive a vaccine. So I think the first premises of medicine of first do no harm applies here too. And again, we have over 30 vaccines being tested in phase one and 15 in phase two and 11 in phase three in the United States. So it's reassuring to know that we have many candidates.
We're talking with Dr. Leo Nisala, who's a physician and research scientist who focuses on clinical trials and drug development. And we're looking at the path forward for a COVID-19 vaccine. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. I want to take a moment to look at the FDA in all of this because there's been so much heightened scrutiny of the FDA and certainly its emergency use authorizations and transparency. So what is the role of the FDA as this as a drug comes to market?
So the FDA has been a beacon of light through the course of its existence, shedding information and trusted data and trusted drug approvals. So it's an institute that has a name for itself worldwide. Many, many countries look up to the FDA as to provide guidance as to drugs should be available for all or not. That said, we live in a very interesting period of time. And in times like this, we see that strong leadership matters. And just to step back for a moment, the virus that has caused COVID-19 has infected over 7 million people in the United States and almost 40 million people worldwide. And there have been over 215,000 deaths this year in the United States alone. And as a doctor, to me, this is outrageous. And at the same time, it's very heartbreaking too. So that alone should make us take some time to acknowledge that there will be over 200,000 empty seats during Thanksgiving. And COVID for me is personal too. I have lost a loved one to the coronavirus.
I'm sorry.
I understand how it feels to not be able to say goodbye and to give your family member, not be able to give your family member a last hug or to say your piece because of the safety precautions. So this has been very heartbreaking for all of us. And more importantly, when we see shocking news like the herd immunity approach
The
gets me
White House
concerned.
has endorsed a petition calling for the end of social distancing. Instead, the petition is arguing that young and healthy people should go out, live their lives as usual, and more people contracting the virus, eventually reaching herd immunity. What are your thoughts on this?
And thanks for asking this. I was shocked when I saw it, and I immediately thought about seniors and underserved communities that have been hit hardest by this pandemic, and also thought about my aunt who fell ill for COVID and passed away, and I'm concerned for them. The short answer is that the plan for herd immunity is no plan at all. But let me explain why I think that. The virus spreads through droplets. It spreads through aerosol. And in conditions where the ventilation is poor, or limited, it has a higher chance of contracting. And the infection fatality rate of COVID, it's several times higher than the seasonal influenza. And for me, it's shocking that after over 200 people, 1,000 people have died, we're trying to compare it to the flu. And there's another important point that the infection can lead to persistent illness in young, healthy people. And in fact, I have a good friend of mine. He's a medical oncologist in Florida. He's a world-renowned lung oncologist, and he registered important immunotherapy drugs for lung cancer patients. And he's a very fit individual that used to run 5 miles every day. And because he was working in the hospital, unfortunately, he contracted the virus in the beginning of this year. And he needed to be hospitalized. He was put on experimental treatments. And months after he got COVID, he's still experiencing long COVID symptoms. So once a patient gets COVID, it's unclear how long this protective immunity will last. And like other seasonal coronaviruses, this virus is capable of reinfecting people who have already had the disease and who developed antibodies. And we saw the first case of this in South Korea in the beginning of the year, and now we saw the first case in the United States this month.
We're running short on time here, and I just want to ask you, what are you watching for in this era right now of vaccine development? What is something that you're keeping an eye on?
That's a great point to end this. And I think this time that we live of high political interest, it's important to have clinical data transparency from the vaccine study. So doctors and scientists alike are encouraging the population to feel calm about a new vaccine, but we are also encouraging the companies that are making those vaccines to make those data points available to scientists like myself, so we can actually look at the scientific collaboration between health agencies and drug companies, so we can feel about confident about the good news that are on the way.
Dr. Nisala, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Leo Nisala is a physician and research scientist focusing on clinical trials and drug development. Coming up, we talk with former State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. He's co-chairing a bipartisan group that's spreading a message to Wisconsin voters that they can trust the voting system amid the pandemic, regardless of what format they cast their ballot. We'll learn about the efforts of Vote Safe Wisconsin right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the group Vote Safe Wisconsin here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This bipartisan coalition was formed to advance this message. Every American has the right to vote safely and securely. The group formed over the summer. It's led by Attorney General Josh Call and former Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. Are you concerned about how you'll vote safely and in person? Have you already voted absentee out of concern with the surge in COVID throughout our state? We're at 800-642-1234. The co-chair of Vote Safe Wisconsin, J.B. Van Hollen, was state attorney general from 2007 to 2015. Former Attorney General Van Hollen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be back on.
Why do you think that this coalition is necessary?
Well, I don't know that it's necessary. I feel like we have an intelligent electorate, but we have so many people out there due to COVID who I know personally have concerns about the safety of voting in person. And there are an awful lot of people who are voting absentee who have never done so before. So the belief is that if we can help guide people and explain how safe the polling places are, as well as guiding people to submit their absentee ballots early, that it can't do anything but help.
How safe are the polling places? What have you seen in terms of preparing for November 3rd?
We think preparation is really, really high. Our municipal clerks have done a phenomenal job of reacting to the COVID crisis. Of course, we had some concerns on the first election in April, but since then, they've had plenty of time to staff up, to make sure that an adequate number of polling places are open, to make sure that there are safety measures such as disinfecting between every voter, letting voters take the pens with them, keeping plexiglass or glass between themselves and voters when they're showing ID. I'm very confident that unless you have a very significant health issue, that there really isn't any safety issue in going to your polling place.
And on the flip side of that, absentee voting has just skyrocketed. It's ballooned in Wisconsin, elsewhere around the country as well, to note. But a lot of people are concerned that there's a lot riding here, that everything's going to work well with the post office, and there are no glitches in the process of getting their ballot to the clerk on time. What can you tell us there?
Well, that's why General Call and I have been doing media appearances. We've been doing print, radio, television, encouraging people to request their absentee ballot very early and to submit it right away. If there's going to be a glitch with the post office, hopefully that glitch can be overcome in time. People have a chance to find ballots that may have been misplaced. The post office has a time to get things pushed through. I think if people wait too long, like 5 days before the election, to submit their ballot, they're going to have reason to be concerned about whether it's going to arrive to their polling place on time.
Well, if you plan to vote absentee, you have to request a ballot by 5 o'clock on October 29th. But we've been hearing that, you know, you really need to do that earlier. What do you see out there?
Just from what I've seen personally and from my business and getting mail, sometimes it can take up to a week to receive your mail. So if you're going to wait till 5 days from election to request a ballot, expect to get it and then get it returned and have it counted, I think you are taking a risk. So for that reason, we're telling people if you're going to vote absentee, you better do it soon. You're running out of time to make sure that you can guarantee or almost guarantee your ballot's going to be received on time. And that if you haven't done it yet, don't fear voting in person. We are very confident in trying to get the message out that voting in person is extremely safe.
We've also learned this election cycle about intelligent mail barcodes, which will be used for ballots sent out in the November election, and the clerks will be able to track ballots at every step of the way, and we can actually see that at myvote.wi.gov. What should we know about these intelligent mail barcodes?
Well, the nice thing about those is if people have submitted an absentee ballot, they can track that ballot and determine whether it's been received, and if so, when. It gives the people, I think, a measure of security when they vote absentee in making sure that they know that their vote is being counted because it's actually been received.
We're talking with J.B. Van Hollen, co-chair of the Vote Safe Wisconsin Coalition, which aims to encourage safe voting. Van Hollen is former state attorney general. He's working on this initiative with Attorney General Josh Call. You can join in. What questions do you have about your ballot and about how, you know, safe you feel in going to the polls on November 3rd? We're at 800-642-1234. You know, we've also been concerned about a shortage of poll workers, and we've been learning through the Wisconsin Elections Commission that there's going to be, you know, lots of backup poll workers and ways to ensure that the polls can be adequately staffed. But are you concerned about having enough poll workers throughout the state?
We were concerned about having enough poll workers early on. I think poll workers were concerned about COVID too and coming in contact with so many people. But I wouldn't hesitate to be a poll worker now because the same safety measures that have been put in place for voters are there protecting poll workers as well, between the plexiglass, the sanitization, the distancing, the masks. And I think because of that, and in part because of the importance of this election, people have really stepped up, and we have some places say they're way overstaffed with poll workers, but that's a good thing. People can get more breaks, and when it comes to counting absentee ballots, of course, you can't count those until Election Day, and the more workers there are to start counting absentee ballots, of course, the quicker we're going to get results.
Some Republicans, including President Trump, have come out adamantly against mail-in voting, saying it encourages voter fraud. What is your response to that?
Well, the problem with the term mail-in voting is that it's so generic, because you look at President Trump also says that absentee voting is okay. So it really depends upon what the definition is. In Wisconsin, we have a form of mail-in voting, but it is a form that has been used for many years, and it has been used very successfully for many years. It still requires a witness signature, the address of the witness the address of the person who voted. You still have to have an ID to be able to request an absentee ballot. In Wisconsin, I believe that our absentee voting system is secure as it can be. There are types of mail-in voting, of course, that some can argue are risky as far as getting fraud into the system. But in Wisconsin, if you're going to have mail-in voting in of any form, I think we have as secure a form as you could possibly have.
In terms of the technology, the tabulators, the all of the tech involved in processing these ballots, is Wisconsin up to date on that and the security of these tabulators?
You know, I'm not an expert in that area. I think we're in pretty good shape. We haven't had great concern with those in the past. From things I've seen, there is a risk with tabulators, and there's going to be a risk even with the newest forms. You can't take complete risk out of the electoral system and still make it as accessible as we do in Wisconsin. But I think in Wisconsin, we've done a good job of balancing, making sure that people get results as promptly as possible, as well as making sure that people have the ability to vote, as well as making sure we keep fraud out of the system.
Let's take a call now. John is joining us from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. My question was whether or not there's a system for checking whether or not your vote was counted, seeing as a lot of people have questions about the safety of elections and whatnot. I was wondering if that had ever been in discussion or if just the logistics of having the voter know that their vote was received and counted was too much to handle.
Great question.
Yeah, the same safety measures that have always been in place are in place now. In addition to that, we have the safety measure that was mentioned earlier by Kate of the barcodes on the absentee ballots to make sure they're received. I think we have to assume that if you vote in person, that your vote's being counted, and we have to assume that if your absentee ballot has been received, that that's going to be counted as well. Of course, you know, the risk is in poll workers, but there are so many, and there are poll observers and poll watchers that I'm very confident that that takes place.
Where do the poll watchers, the poll observers come from?
They come from all walks of life. Usually, especially in the more major areas, poll watchers and poll observers are usually sent there by both political parties. When I was attorney general, we sent out assistant attorneys general to be poll watchers to make sure everything functioned properly and to answer legal questions if anything arose. There are also occasionally plainclothes law enforcement who are out there. So, between poll workers and poll watchers, you got both parties covered, and you have people who are there under the guise of working for the municipality, but other people who are clearly there representing one political party or the other.
Matt called from Green Bay, couldn't stay with us. Matt says for the primary, Matt requested an absentee ballot and handed it in person at the polls. For the upcoming election, Matt automatically received an absentee ballot in the mail, wants to vote in person, and is asking, does he need to bring that in, that ballot in, to nullify now that this mail ballot is out there?
Yeah, he doesn't. The nice thing about absentee ballots is you can request them and you can change your mind. So people who have requested absentee ballots who have decided that they don't want to vote absentee can just dispose of that ballot and go in and vote in person on election day. They don't need to do anything more.
We're talking with former Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. He is co-chair of the group Vote Safe Wisconsin alongside Attorney General Josh Call. Do you know what the options are for voting if you don't want to go to the polls? Do you care for an elderly parent or grandparent and worry about them not being healthy enough to go to the polls on election day? Are you concerned about how long it might take the Postal Service to deliver your absentee ballot to the clerk's office? Join in with your concerns about voting safely and securely, taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with former Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with former Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. He's co-chairing a group called Vote Safe Wisconsin that's spreading a message that Wisconsinites can have faith in the system, cast their ballot safely amid the pandemic. You know, election officials across Wisconsin reported 19 incidents of possible voter fraud between the 2018 general election and this year's fall partisan primary. So looking at data between February of 2019 and August of 2020, what do you think about voter fraud and irregularities?
Well, one of the things we do in VoteSafe is to try not to make policy statements because it's a bipartisan coalition, and we want to try to keep it that way. So we're focused on encouraging people to vote, talking about how safe and secure our system is, as opposed to whether voter fraud exists or not, for that matter. You know, obviously, we think collectively that we have as little voter fraud in Wisconsin under our system as we can probably have, while still securing people's rights to vote if they want to. Even if you argue that there is voter fraud out there, the reality is you're not going to, in my opinion, be able to completely eliminate it and still be able to allow people to vote who want to. I think we've struck a phenomenal balance in the state of Wisconsin. If you're afraid of fraud, there's probably not a whole lot more we can do here in the state other than vote ourselves. Vote in person if you're very fearful of fraud, because that's the greatest guarantee of having your vote counted. And volunteer to be a poll worker. That's obviously another way that you can help monitor the system yourself.
So take part in the process, actively participate. Let's bring in Kevin now in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to vote absentee again here in November. I did in the primary spring elections in April and downloaded my photo ID. Is it still on file, or do I have to submit a new photo ID?
Kevin, thanks. Well,
The photo ID is for registration. You should be fine with the photo ID that's been submitted in the past. You request an absentee ballot. You can go even to your municipal clerk's office and pick up an absentee ballot. So there are a number of ways you can do it. And as we're getting close in time, if you haven't received it yet or requested it yet, you may want to consider going to your municipal clerk's office and dropping off the absentee ballot as well.
Kevin, thanks. Let's go to Hadi in Madison. Hi, Hadi.
Hi, I have just a couple of questions. The first one is, how did we get here that people in around the world are laughing at our long lines? I came to this country 25 years ago, and today I can't believe you can't get up and go vote and be trust and trust the system. That's one. The second one is, it's my feeling anyway that Republicans always want to limit. They always are bringing something to limit votes, and Democrats always want to expand. How can't we get this right?
Hadi, thank you for that. And, you know, Hadi brings up voter suppression. I know your coalition is bipartisan and wants to stay out of politics, but can you address what Hadi is saying?
Yeah, I think to some degree. I mean, addressing the second question first, I think that's what's so wonderful about this coalition. He argues that, you know, Republicans want a lower voter turnout and Democrats want a higher voter turnout. Well, we've got Republicans and Democrats, not just myself and General Call, but many more elected and former elected officials in both parties, organizations, clerks, people along those lines who are basically saying, hey, we want everybody to vote who is entitled to do so. But we want to make sure that people who aren't entitled to do so don't vote, or people don't vote more than once or vote for fictitious individuals. And we think Wisconsin has a system in place that strikes that great balance. That's why we're out there in a bipartisan nature saying vote and use one of our methods. We believe it's very secure. We believe it's very safe. And we believe that everybody who wants to can and should get out there and vote. With regard to, I think he was addressing long lines.
The ability to vote.
We are going to have longer lines now than we've had in the past. There's no doubt about it. I know in the April election, because of lack of volunteers, fear of COVID, lack of preparation, places like the city of Milwaukee had fewer polling places. I think we've addressed that to the best degree we can, under a pandemic. We have the polling places we need that are open, so we have the correct numbers. We have a good number of poll workers, but there are still going to be lines because we want to keep separation. We want to make sure that we protect voters as well. We want people to vote, and the only way I think to really get people to vote safely is to make sure that we implement ways to protect them. And because of that, there are going to be a little bit longer lines. I believe it's such an important right that people, I think, can endure those lines, as we've seen them do in other countries, to make sure that they get the chance to vote. And if we don't want to wait in the lines, request an absentee ballot, drop it off at your municipal clerk's office. There will be no line whatsoever. Or you can actually go into the clerk's office, request the ballot right there, and vote and drop it off if you want to go early and do your job without waiting on election day.
We're talking with J.B. Van Hollen, co-chair of the Vote Safe Wisconsin Coalition, which is spreading the message that voting is safe and secure. Van Hollen is a former state attorney general, and he's serving in this group alongside his co-chair, Attorney General Josh Call, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in George in Monroe. Hi, George.
Hi. My question is whether there are rules being developed for where poll watchers can stand while absentee ballots are being processed. I know in my experience they're kept well behind the lines. They're not supposed to harass or be in anybody's way. And with all the talk about aggressive poll watchers, how are we going to deal with that?
George, thanks.
Well, the clerks are very well educated as to what poll workers can do and what poll watchers can do. They further have guidance as to how to handle distancing and things along those lines because of COVID. I don't think any of those things are changing, and I don't think any of those things are going to change between now and Election Day, or I don't think they're going to change between one polling place and another polling place. Obviously, poll watchers are going to have to keep a certain distance because we don't want them to interfere with actual poll workers, especially since poll watchers, many of them, are there representing one party or the other. And we want to make sure, once again, with COVID, that people keep their distances. So I'm sure there is a degree of separation, and the poll workers are the ones who are the local municipal clerks are the ones who are responsible for that, and we have to trust in their judgment that they're executing it according to the appropriate regulations.
George, thanks for that call. You know, there have been a number of groups, including the Bucks basketball team, have joined the Vote Safe Wisconsin Coalition. What does having the Bucks as part of this how does that further your cause?
Well, once again, we're trying to get the message out to voters as to the different methodologies of voting, how to go about doing it, and that it is safe and secure. And different people reach different venues. Obviously, if politicians are out there talking, some people say, well, we believe that. And other people say, well, we're never going to believe a thing they say. I think there's a different demographic, at least in part, that would watch and listen to a star such as Antetokounmpo or who watches the Bucks, who are going to appreciate the fact that they're chiming in as well. So I think we're trying to reach all demographics. We're trying to reach all walks of life. And I think the more different groups we get on, the more different approaches we take to reaching out to people, the better progress we're going to make.
Well, let's land on resources here. Where should Wisconsin residents turn to get help in deciding the process, how to vote, learning where their resources are? What would you point them to?
The Wisconsin Elections Commission. You can just go online, you type in the Wisconsin Elections Commission. They've got a number of different tools on there. They show you how to request an absentee ballot. They'll talk about how the system works. Just about any question you want to get answered, I think, can be answered by the Wisconsin Election Commission.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it was great to be on. I appreciate the opportunity. Once again, we encourage people to vote. Vote early if you're requesting an absentee. Do so very, very soon. We're running out of time. Otherwise, don't fear voting in person.
J.B. Van Hollen, co-chair of Vote Safe Wisconsin Coalition and former state attorney general serving that role from 2007 to 2015. Just ahead, We'll hear from a housing attorney about what options people have who are facing eviction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.